This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Tiara Vian, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. Thanks for listening to this week's podcast. For the week of October 8th, here are some top stories.
Powerful water users are negotiating an expanded plan to deal with Lake Mead. The lake level is dropping due to overallocation and drought. And at the same time, water security for major Arizona cities relies in part on their place at the front of the line for Colorado River water, a position they want to protect. KJZZ's Brett Jaspers reports.
Troy Hayes at Phoenix's Water Services Department gave me a tour of the Union Hills Water Treatment Plant. It takes in water from the Central Arizona Project canal right behind it.
We bring water off that canal, and we're adding a few chemicals here to get the heavier materials to fall out.
That's one step to clean the water. Another is to put it through a centrifuge.
What this is a mechanical device that spins at a really high rate, separating the water from the other particulate matter that may be within the water.
This plant was built in the 1980s and serves the growing northern part of the city. Phoenix has other plants from the 50s and 60s.
How long does a plant typically last?
The funny answer is forever. But that forever takes continuous investment in rehabbing and replacing the infrastructure that's inside of it.
And the city needs more infrastructure. If the Colorado River system crashes, Phoenix will need to take banked water to the distribution spots now served by the Union Hills plant. The Water Services Department recently asked City Council for a 12% increase in water rates spread over 2 years. It's to pay for transmission mains and other upgrades in the city.
We're concerned about making sure that the supplies we have today are resilient and can really withstand those kinds of system shocks.
Catherine Sorensen is director of Phoenix Water Services. She says if all of the Colorado River water were to disappear instantly, the city could survive for generations. It has Salt and Verde River water, groundwater, and banked water. But in the current negotiations over the drought contingency plan, Phoenix is laser focused on keeping water in Lake Mead to avoid a crash.
At the end of the day, we have far less risk tolerance than some of the other stakeholders at the table because we have to make sure people have water all the time.
And there's another pole holding up Phoenix's water security tent. Along with other cities and tribes, it holds a position earlier in line for Colorado River water, according to a priority system. That water is the cash the city has been banking.
The priority system is what we have invested in.
Warren Tenney is executive director of AMWA, an association of 10 Valley cities. As various water users negotiate a statewide pact, he doesn't want a disruption to the priority system.
And to say, we need to alter it just a little bit right now, would set a precedent. It sets a precedent that makes us worry about, well, what are we going to be asked to do in 5 years or in 10 years from now?
5 and 10 years from now is right around the corner. The negotiators of the drought contingency plan want to get this deal done because the rest of the basin is waiting and there are other things to work on. Shane Leonard runs the Roosevelt Water Conservation District in Maricopa County. He doesn't think anyone wants to change the priority system.
You're beginning to see folks who are looking at it again, not just simply with blinders on relative to what their uses are, but what everybody else's uses are.
A solid deal now, he says, will establish trust for the next one.
If we get this done and it gets a little pressure off, I suspect that the next step, not just in Arizona, but all the Colorado River water users, is going to be to look exactly at the overallocation and snowpack.
That would be another big undertaking. Overallocation has vexed the Colorado River system since the original compact almost 100 years ago. You might say water security isn't a destination, it's a process. Brett Jaspers, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
This story is part of Elemental, a new public media collaboration covering sustainability in the West.
Now from KJZZ's original production, The Show, here's co-host Lauren Gilger and Mark Brody.
If you drive in certain parts of the valley, you might be getting used to seeing self-driving cars on the road. Waymo has a fleet of minivans with big cameras on top driving around the East Valley. And in April of last year, the Google company launched an early ridership program here.
Now hundreds of people here can call up a driverless car to go to work or to the doctor, or in the case of Tempe retiree Barbara Adams, to go to her weekly book club or to meet friends for dinner. Or
my very favorite thing to do is to go to the mall, because in the summertime you don't have to park and walk a million miles in 120 degree heat. And at Christmas time you don't have to find a place to park. You just step out of the car and wherever you want to be, and you can shop your way through the mall. And when you get to the other end, you just step out to whatever that curb is and call the Waymo again.
Adams is one of the early riders who signed up to be in the early adopters for this burgeoning technology. And she says for her and her husband, it was a matter of convenience more than anything else.
Originally, we found it because the announcement to sign up early riders was on the computer one morning. And my husband said, "You want to do this? This sounds like fun." And I went, okay. We had, at that point, we had three of us, my youngest son and the two of us, and we only had two cars, and so it was sometimes got a little dicey about that, and we thought, oh, well, this will give us another car, another opportunity, and also we're just so fascinated by the technology.
What do your friends think? What do the other people in your life think? Are people, like, completely flabbergasted by the fact that you do this, or what was the reaction?
They always want to see it. You know, what do you do? And, well, you walk up to it and you press the button and you get in, you know. But everyone's just, you know, they're just, like in my book club, they all want to go outside and see me get in the Waymo.
But self-driving cars have a long way to go before everyone is ready to jump in and take a ride. In March, the public perception of the technology had a massive setback when an autonomous Uber vehicle hit and killed a Tempe woman who was crossing the street at night. Since then, the company ended its self-driving operations and testing here in the valley.
So Waymo is slowly rolling out its technology here and focusing on safety, but its cars have been driving on public roads here for some time now. In fact, today the company announced its vehicles have officially driven 10 million miles on public roads, many of them right here in Arizona. And I got to check out how it all works at their Chandler facilities. Product manager Clem Wright showed me around the Chrysler Pacifica minivan.
So let's take a look towards the front of the car. And you can see these little spinning gray LiDAR. So these let us use lasers to see things that are near the car, like smaller people or a ball that might be rolling under the car. We also have radar that lets us see how far away things are and how fast they're moving.
And then the camera's on top, right?
Yeah,
this is the thing you can actually recognize if you see the car driving around.
Yeah, you'll see the big black dome on top. So that has camera in it, which lets us see high definition and in color, so we can see you know, what color a traffic light is, so we know when we can go. Mm-hmm. And there's also long-range LiDAR up at the top, and that lets us see up to 3 football fields in all directions and detect objects that are coming.
So what else is there that's distinct about this?
So yeah, let's just take a look inside, and you can see some of the other things that differentiate us. So you can see we have a child seat in the back for any of our early riders who want to take a child along. And we can fit 3 adults. We also have our test drivers who are sitting in front. You can say hi to them.
Hi, guys.
Hi. And so you can see on the back of the driver's seat headrest and the front passenger seat headrest, we have passenger screens. So these let the user know what's going on. So they're telling us to close the doors, fasten our seatbelts, and then press start.
That's my door, isn't it?
Take a look up here, a console with a few different buttons. And one is a help button, so that contacts our rider support team. There's also a lock-unlock door button, a button to pull over if you want to do that, and then a nice big blue button to start the ride.
So if I were in the early rider program and it comes to my house, it picks me up, I get in the back seat or the middle seat here in one of these pilot seats, are these two nice gentlemen in the front, or is this no one's in the front seat?
In some of our rides, we do have no one in the front seat. We do have test drivers in our rides as well.
Okay, so that's like a mind bend for a lot of people, right? How do you address that with people? Are the people who are signing up excited about that?
They're really excited, and I think once we get riding, we'll see how the passenger screens help tell the story of what the car is perceiving and thinking and planning to do next. And that does a lot to help people feel more comfortable of, the car knows what it's going to do.
Okay, you want to get going?
Yeah, let's do it. Do you want to go ahead and press the start ride button?
Okay, so it says on the screen in front of us where we are.
Yeah.
And then the car's just going.
And if you take a look, the driver up front has his hands off the steering wheel, and the steering wheel is moving on its own.
Yeah, you are not touching that steering wheel. That is weird.
It's a pretty cool experience, yeah.
Okay, so it's just kind of slowly maneuvering around everything, but you can see on the screen right in front of us everything around us. Like there are little squares or rectangles for all the other cars. Mm-hmm. Oh, there's one that just jumped over there. And then that comes up there. You can even see the trees are kind of appearing and not appearing. What else do you see on the screen all the time?
So if you see the path ahead of where the car is planning to go. So you can see these other objects, whether they're pedestrians or vehicles that we're planning around. And then you can see, hey, okay, the car's gonna take a right here around this corner. You also see the street name that you're currently on, location, and some other information. So maybe it's a 10-mile-per-hour zone, or maybe you're moving up to a 40-mile-per-hour zone.
So let's talk about this early ridership program. First of all, why Phoenix?
Phoenix is great. The local community has been really welcoming to us here, and the weather is great for self-driving cars. It's really sunny, and the roads are nice and wide, and it's a good place to start to learn to drive.
And the regulations here make it a little easier, right?
That is true, yeah.
So how many, you said hundreds of people are in this early ridership program to begin with?
Yes, we have hundreds of people taking rides every day, so over 400 riders we announced in June.
So do you pay to be in this program? How did you get people involved?
We had tons of people sign up just out of enthusiasm and excitement for the program. To take rides, people do pay for the rides. However, to sign up to be in the program, people are just really excited.
There has been some controversy around self-driving cars, definitely with Uber, who had to basically pack up and move out of Arizona after that accident that killed a woman in Tempe not long ago. So there are safety concerns. People are afraid of that, I'm sure. How is Waymo addressing that, especially in rolling this out here?
Yeah, safety is 100% our number one concern, and it should be for any company that's entering this space. And the biggest thing we can do is grow experience. So we've recently reached over 10 million miles driving on public roads and 7 billion miles in simulation. So that's when we simulate a car driving and add additional constraints to ensure that we're doing the safe thing. So it really comes back to that experience. We've amassed that over 9 years, taking rides and teaching our cars how to drive. And at every stage, we proceed with safety as the number one thing in mind.
I want to ask a little bit about oversight. One of the things that is a criticism of companies like this is that there's not a lot of federal oversight, nothing like you would have to if you were putting a new plane on the market or something like that. Is that something that Waymo is addressing, or do you think that that adds a layer of difficulty in terms of trust for customers?
I think that we are working very closely with relevant authorities as we proceed, and at every step of the way, we're ensuring that we're abiding by the law. And since safety is such just core to our experience, that we feel that we can get that message out.
So let's talk about the public perception of this. Like when we sat down and the car started driving itself, yeah. That freaks me out, right? As somebody who's never seen that before, is this like a slow process for people, the general public, to say, yeah, I totally trust this?
Yeah, I think that's totally fair. I think we're introducing a totally new paradigm into the world. And any big change like that is going to take time for people to accept. And that's why when we launch our service, is going to be an incremental rollout. We're going to go step by step and make sure that we are, as we expand to more area, we're doing it in a really safe way. And as people are getting more and more accustomed to our cars, we can proceed further.
What are some of the bigger challenges in terms of making this technology work that the company has addressed and tried to fix and that have been not so easy to fix?
Yeah, for sure. So we spoke a little bit about why Phoenix is a great place to drive because of the weather. We've worked really hard. We're driving in tons of different parts of the country. We're driving in Michigan, for example, to learn how to deal with snow. It's not a problem for Phoenix, but for snow, for example, one of the things we do is use machine learning technology to adjust, and basically we can see through the snow in some sense. And so it's hard to describe in layman's terms, but through like careful simulation, we can actually be able to see through what might look opaque to a normal human driver with our sensors.
So that would be better than a human driver?
In some cases, yes. There are a lot of advantages to our technology. So a normal human driver might get sleepy or tired, or they might drink some alcohol. Our cars never get drunk, they never get tired, and they can see in 360 degrees in all directions, up to 3 football fields lengths away.
And I guess that's one of the main premises underlying all of this kind of technology, right, is that human drivers are not that good. Driving is pretty dangerous still, right?
Yeah, I think the fact that our cars don't text has a lot going for it. I think there's still a lot to learn, and we're being very careful as we roll this technology out, but we do think there's room to improve on how humans are driving today.
It's barely rolling out here now. There have been some bumps along the way in terms of the technology as a whole. At this point, when you look forward 10, 20, 50 years down the road, is this technology pervasive? Like, do we not each own our own car and drive ourselves to work every day?
You know, it's always hard to predict the future and exactly when these things will happen. And in different areas of the country, our technology will be ready sooner, and there'll be certain places where it makes more sense to roll out faster. I think humans behind the wheel will be a reality for a considerable time, but we'll slowly roll this out and make sure that we are helping get it out there as quickly as possible, because, you know, we do believe it will be safer for the world.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you.
Clem Wright is a product manager at Waymo, who gave me a ride along in one of the company's self-driving cars.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening. From the business desk, a copper mining city in northern Sonora, known as the birthplace of the Mexican Revolution, is hoping to use that history to draw more tourists. KJZZ's Murphy Woodhouse reports.
You walk up, and you can see the indentation that the feet have been making for over 100 years.
That's Humberto de Hoyos, an amateur historian leading me up the stairs at the old Cananea City Jail, which now serves as the Museum of Worker Struggle. I'm here to learn about the town's unique past.
The first thing that greets us here is the newspaper. The first newspaper printed in Cananea was September 21st, 1902, and it was in English. Back then, Cananea was more of an American town than a Mexican town.
He tells me it was William Cornell Green's founding of the Cananea Consolidated Copper Company in 1899 that marked the beginning of the town's modern era. But it was what happened in 1906 that forever secured Cananea's place in Mexican history. That summer, Mexican miners paid less and treated worse than their American counterparts went on strike. 23 were killed in the ensuing bloodshed. Strike leaders were jailed, where we are standing.
You have to realize the strike was in 1906, and the revolution started in 1910, 4 years later. But what sparked everything was the strike here in Cananea.
That's the dramatic history many in Cananea hope will earn the town recognition as a Pueblo Mágico, or magical town. That federal designation is reserved for Mexican communities with unique historic and cultural significance, as well as tourism potential. It also brings much-needed support for infrastructure projects and cachet among travelers. This week, federal officials are considering adding several towns to the current list of 111 Pueblos Mágicos. Two more Sonoran cities are also in the running, along with dozens of others across Mexico. I sat down with city officials Oscar Damian Hernandez and Alejandro Villa to hear what it would mean for Cananea.
Hola, buenos días.
He says those resources can be used for running utility lines underground, beautification of buildings, promotion, support for cultural events, and training for hotel owners and restaurant operators. But even if Cananea doesn't win, Villa says the years-long effort to get here has instilled pride in the community for its complex history and unique turn-of-the-19th-century architecture. According to Villa, people started realizing that what they saw as ordinary, their homes, buildings, history, and traditions, were valuable. The Pueblos Mágicos program has not been without controversy. Through the 2000s, the program grew slowly, with a handful of new cities being added each year. Then in 2012, the last year of Felipe Calderón's presidency, several dozen were added, leading to charges of political favors. A similar jump came in 2015 under outgoing President Enrique Peña Nieto. The incoming tourism secretary was recently quoted saying designations were given out like gifts. He is calling for a review of the program. Hernandez welcomes that review. That review, Hernandez says, will just show that Cananea deserves the title. He added that the review also opens up a window of opportunity for Cananea and others. An hour and a half west in Magdalena de Quino, a band plays for pilgrims exiting the San Francisco Javier Chapel. During the first week of October, thousands travel to the town to pay homage to Magdalena's patron saint. Magdalena was founded in 1687 by Jesuit Father Eusebio Quino. His remains are on display in the charming main square. That square has recently seen major improvements, thanks to its designation as a Pueblo Mágico in 2012. The number of visitors in the hotels and restaurants serving them have risen.
Definitivamente, el nombramiento de Magdalena.
That's Raúl Mian, a part of the committee that works to maintain program eligibility. He says Magdalena has benefited economically as a Pueblo Mágico, but it's also instilled a sense of pride among residents. Brian Savoy brought his mother, son, and fiancée Martha Garcia down for the festival from Tucson. He's been a regular visitor for decades because his mother was born and raised in Magdalena.
It's beautiful down here. The people. Everybody invites you in. Everybody's caring and loving down here.
Garcia.
I definitely believe that this recognition that it's getting now definitely deserves it.
For Garcia, a first-time Fiestas visitor and strong believer in the miracles of San Francisco, Magdalena was a magical place. Murphy Woodhouse, KJZZ News, Magdalena, Mexico.
From the Fronteras Desk.
The Mexico City Olympic Games began exactly 50 years ago today. The game's vibrant visual identity became the icon of an era and a country, and the style is celebrated as a cornerstone for contemporary graphic design. But its success also brought an ongoing dispute between people from both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border. From KJZZ's Mexico City Bureau, Rodrigo Cervantes reports.
This is the beautiful capital of Mexico.
In the official movie of the Mexican Olympic Games, we can see the legendary design everywhere. The font made out of parallel lines, the bright colors, and the simplistic iconography.
Design can transcend into culture.
That's Christoph Niemann, a German illustrator known from his work in New York and his appearance on the Netflix series Abstract. He recognizes the importance of the Mexico 68 graphic identity. Many like him see the Mexico 68 concept as a cultural icon and the visual identity of Mexico in the 60s, and it's made a comeback through retro culture and brands like Adidas. But behind the font, colors, and icons, a conflict has lingered for five decades between American designer Lance Wyman and Mexican architect Pedro Ramirez Vázquez. Javier Ramirez walks me inside a house in Mexico City that looks more like a museum, with memorabilia from Mexico 68 everywhere. It's the estate from his deceased father, the renowned architect Pedro Ramirez Vázquez. Ramirez Vázquez was responsible for the construction of the Aztec Stadium, among many other emblematic buildings. He served as president of the organizing committee of the Mexico 68 Olympics. It is one thing to help develop the project, it is another to create it, Ramirez says. Wyman claims to be the author of the Mexico 68 graphic concepts, but Ramirez says it came from his father's ideas and the teamwork from many, including Wyman. Ramirez shows me dozens of documents, letters, the intellectual property title, and sketches of the logo that he says proved Ramirez Vázquez's authorship. He says Ramirez Vázquez saw in the Olympics an opportunity to honor the cultural heritage of Mexico while showing a modern country to the world. But his legacy has been tarnished by the conflict with Wyman. On the other side of the city, Lance Wyman, now in his 80s, walks into a design convention like a rock star, waving and taking selfies with fans. Wyman's work include corporate logos and the iconography for the subways of Mexico City and Washington, D.C. He currently works on a project with the sports brand Puma, based on the Mexico 68 identity that he claims as his.
I can't speak Spanish, but I can make icons.
Wyman says he asked for his credit when he first started to work with Ramirez Vázquez, but the deal was closed with a handshake.
I'm still working on that, making that handshake be, authentic now.
According to Wyman, linear patterns from pre-Columbian cultures and the 60s up art inspired him back then. He acknowledges Ramirez Vázquez as a genius, but says that no one will take back his ownership on the Mexico 68 design.
I don't want to dirty this thing any more than it is because, I mean, literally, it's been a real pain in the ass, and we all worked so well together, you know?
'60s music set the mood at a party to celebrate 50 years since the Mexico City Olympics. Carolina Borja is one of the organizers and the cultural director for the Route of Friendship Board of Trustees, a nonprofit to preserve Mexico 68's cultural program. And for her, the legacy of the celebrated design belongs to Mexico.
I think it should be a motivation for generations to come. It should stand more as an icon of what we were able to do as a country.
As part of the anniversary celebrations, Ramirez will offer conferences in Mexico City and Wyman at Arizona State University. And so far, no activities together. Rodrigo Cervantes, KJZZ News, Mexico City.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. From the Education Desk, here's KJZZ's co-host Lauren Gilger and Steve Goldstein.
Several Republican leaders in Arizona, including Governor Doug Ducey, State Senator Kate Brophy McGee, and Attorney General Mark Brnovich, have spoken out about the need for charter school reform in recent months. There are calls from both sides of the aisle for charter schools to be more transparent about their finances and follow the same conflict of interest and procurement laws that district schools already do. Those reactions came after reporting from the Arizona Republic's Craig Harris that uncovered insider deals that have allowed charter school owners to make millions.
And this month, a new report from the Office of the Inspector General for the Department of Education highlighted Arizona for having the highest number of charter schools closed down. So, how are charter schools responding? Our co-host Lauren Gilger sat down with Eileen Sigmund, president and CEO of the Arizona Charter Schools Association. Sigmund says they hear the criticism and are taking it very seriously.
What kinds of financial transparency issues are you open to addressing right now? There have been many calls to increase that kind of transparency, especially.
Sure. What we're doing right now is we're certainly talking with our charter leaders daily, with policymakers at the Capitol, with the Attorney General, with the governor's office. And what we're looking at, some areas we're looking at is transparent financial issues, the governing boards of our charters, and then working with the state agency that regulates our charters. Right now, they're in the middle of doing their rulemaking, and we're working with them to make sure that they understand the severe mismanagement and have the proper tools to address those and close schools that are severely financially mismanaged.
When it comes to school closures, that seems like something that needs to be addressed. The Office of the Inspector General at the Department of Education just released a report that highlighted Arizona as having the highest number of closed charter schools from the same school authorizer. What are the procedures now for closing a charter school here, and do you think they need to be changed?
Well, certainly. That report lagged a couple of years. And what happened is in 2010, charter schools came up for their first reviews. And then in 2012, 2013, and 2014, there was a number of schools that either were closed or surrendered their charters, which are considered closures. And the main reason there was the academic accountability. There was also operational accountability. There was a lag as we changed tests and we changed our letter grades. Then you saw in 2017, we received letter grades. All F-rated charters were either told you're going to close or you're going to improve. And in 2018, none of those charters were F-rated. And you don't see that with our district schools because they can fail their students year in and year out. Our charters simply cannot because our charters are different.
They also receive more public money per student than district schools, though, right?
No, that's actually incorrect. If you look at all sources of funding from the joint legislative budget, our charters on average receive $951 less per child. And the reason is that we don't have any access to property taxes, which are the considered local sources of funding. Because our charters don't have boundaries, we only receive state dollars, not access to any of the local property taxes, which are about $2 billion annually.
So you're saying you can't go for a bond or an override, something like that district schools often do to try and supplement funding. But isn't that why state funding is a little higher for charter schools per student?
That is. And then, for example, there's also about $120 million in buckets for teachers that our charters simply can't access, even though we fall under the same rules and regulations. And we all agree that school finance is broken, and we need to look at school finance because in Maricopa County, one out of two families exercise choice by either open enrolling or attending a charter school.
What do you think should change?
So we last updated school finance in 1980 when we had one fax machine in all of state government. Now what we're looking at is we should be focusing on students' needs, not systems' needs, and moving forward in an overhaul to keep pace with the robust movement of our students. Because we still are hearkening back to a time when we had set closed district boundaries instead of this porous environment that policymakers have enacted and families have utilized.
So you're saying essentially that the state money should follow the students?
Absolutely.
I want to talk more about the oversight accountability changes you mentioned that
sure.
You're working with state lawmakers and the governor's office to change. So State Senator Kate Brophy McGee has said she's uncomfortable with some of the nepotism that's exist on charter boards in particular. We're hearing this also from the Republican candidate for superintendent of public instruction, Frank Riggs. He has said he thinks a majority of charter boards should be quote-unquote disinterested individuals, right? Is that the kind of change you're talking about supporting here?
Absolutely. So we're looking to develop a proactive policy response with our lawmakers and our schools to address the key criticisms of governance, financial transparency, and their regulatory authority. And we're making sure for financial transparency that any of the criteria you just said are disclosed and the public is informed and has visibility into what is going on with our public charter's finances.
Any details you can give us on what that might look like at this point? This would be legislation, I'm assuming.
Right. And certainly we're going to have this before the legislative session starts, working with lawmakers. But at this point, we're just looking at some key areas to make sure we're addressing the criticisms and having these conversations and the areas that we discussed and which were outlined already.
So you said, you know, you're hearing the criticism from the community. I wonder if this surprised you in any way, these people who are making millions off of charter schools, the insider deals that were going on that have been uncovered by people like Craig Harris at The Republic.
Yeah, so I want to be clear about what charter schools are and are not. They're public schools operating as a public-private partnership, no different than the contractor for our roads, the hospital contractor to provide care for people needing medical care. And really, what we're looking at, the most important part of this is the academic accountability. That's the reason charters were created. And we're showing results. Two out of three charter schools are earning an A. Where, if you look at the nation's report card, Arizona charter sectors would be number one in eighth grade math, number two in eighth grade reading. And out of every socioeconomic status, demographic, our charters are outperforming. So what we're looking at is that our leaders who have set up this enterprise to provide public education, decades later, if they're receiving a benefit from the enterprise they started, that's not a bad thing because we want to make sure success is being replicated. But again, we also want to make sure our taxpayers have visibility into what's going on. So we are definitely looking at different things, but it's not a perfect model, and we're continuing to evolve the charter sector.
So if you want the taxpayers, the parents who are sending their kids to these schools to be able to see what's going on a financial level, would you support something like the law that was passed for district schools this year that they have to post their budgets, their audit information online that charters were exempt from at the time?
Certainly, we're looking at every angle right now. Our charters already, because the majority, 95%, are nonprofits, they do file with the IRS. So their IRS documents are already public. Again, we're evolving, but what is the right balance for our public charters to succeed and not be wrapped up in red tape is a balance we're trying to strike because charters are not district clones. That's not why they started. That's not how they operate. And we want to continue to make sure that charter schools, public charter schools, are successful for families and students.
So I asked if any of this surprised you because there has been less oversight over charter schools than district schools, and that's part of the model, like you said. I wonder if there's any sense among the complaints that you're hearing from people that why didn't anything change before this came out? Why were these things allowed to happen to begin with?
Well, what I would tell you, Lauren, is we worked proactively to allow the state agency that oversees charters to have a financial tool to close down for mismanagement of finances. We worked on that before any of these stories began. Likewise, academic accountability was something we worked on proactively. And when I say we, I'm talking about the 500 plus charters. We want to make sure we're good stewards of the public trust for academic outcomes and financial transparency.
Do you feel like you've lost some of that public trust?
Well, Lauren, if you look at parent demand for our charter schools, it's increasing. We're showing increased numbers for this school year. So it depends by what measure. But if you're asking if parents are still demanding public charter school options, then the answer is yes. So that's why I wanted to come here with some areas we want to address and know that we're working with the lawmakers, the governor's office, the attorney generals, and then our state regulatory. And these are my school leaders coming up with solutions because there's hundreds of thousands of students that are receiving a quality education, and we want to be able to speak to their issues and to gain the public trust because, yes, we have some concerns.
Okay. Eileen Sigmund, the president and CEO of the Arizona Charter Schools Association. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
And from the Science Desk, here's KJZZ's Nicholas Gerbis.
The U.S. Air Force has chosen three aerospace companies in which to invest $2 billion, including one that builds rockets right here in Chandler. The public-private launch service agreements awarded nearly $792 million to Northrop Grumman Innovation Systems, which acquired defense and space contractor Orbital ATK in June. Blue Origin and United Launch Alliance received contracts of $500 million and $967 million, respectively. The three companies will develop competing domestic launch vehicles to carry defense satellites, with commercial contracts likely to follow. Northrop Grumman is building its intermediate to heavy lift rocket, dubbed Omega, at Orbital's Chandler facilities. Its contract will run through Omega's scheduled certification flights in 2021 and 2024. I'm Nicholas Gerbis in Phoenix.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by Helios Education Foundation, Alliance Bank, the Vitalist Health Foundation, the Intel Corporation, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.